From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point.
Raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed, nothing seems to fit.
If you weren't there to hear it, it's hard to explain the scale of composer Burt Bacharach's footprint in a generation and more of American popular music. It was simply huge, everywhere. 73 top 40 hits, songs like Walk On By, What the World Needs Now is Love, and the song behind me, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, and so many more. Now he's out with a memoir and a look back. This hour on Point, the great Burt Bacharach on a life in music. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Was this your soundtrack growing up? The Burt Bacharach sound in every nook and cranny, everywhere you turned. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now is composer, conductor, arranger, pianist Burt Bacharach. Grammy winner, three-time Oscar, two-time Golden Globe winner, a Gershwin Prize winner, with his longtime writing partner, Hal David. He's written 73 top 40 hits in the U.S., 52 in the U.K., composed for singers like Dionne Warwick, famously, Bobby Gentry, Dusty Springfield, Johnny Mathis, and so many more. Composed for Broadway and film, now he's out with a new memoir written with Robert Greenfield called Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life and Music. Burt Bacharach, in Santa Monica, California, thank you very much for being with us.
Like to be here. Thank you very much. Happy to be with you, Tom.
It's kind of incredible that you can exist. I mean, I guess I am kind
really,
of right
I
in
find the same.
Yeah, no doubt.
I agree with you.
You know,
I am existing.
You're existing, and it's wonderful, but I'm kind of in the sweet spot of your career. I mean, as soon as my ears were opening up as a tiny kid, there were your songs. As I grew up, they were everywhere, everywhere you turned, everywhere you listened. It's hard to believe that one guy, with all the people around you, Hal David and Dion and all the others, did all that. I mean, I have a sense of having grown up, whether I liked it or not, in your world, Burt. That's just an incredible web. How did you ever imagine you would spin music around such a huge part of American life, the world's life?
You cannot imagine something like that. You cannot plan it. It's a happening. Something occurs. You cannot pre-plan something like that, that the music will even last if it's successful. I'm very grateful for the way things – you know, it's a kind of a dreamed life without dreaming. This is the way you want it to be. Mm-hmm. It just kind of rolls to the next song and follows the next project, and you go from one to the other, and your life is devoted to – mostly to making music and trying to do it as well as you can, and whether it's writing that song and then taking it to the next step into the recording studio and trying to get 100% from everybody involved with that recording, whether it's the singer, whether it's the rhythm section, whether the whole orchestra, because I do believe, Tom, that everything happens, lives or dies. When you get into that studio, the song, you can feel very good about it. But the moment of truth is getting into the studio, having everybody execute, having everybody give their maximum at the same time. And you're never going to get to the 100%, but you're going to get as close as you can hold it together with enough people in the studio that some are not going over to they've already peaked and somebody else is just getting it, you know?
Mm-hmm. There are so many stories in this memoir, Anyone Who Had a Heart, and I'm really looking forward to unpacking some of them. Let's just listen to the title track, well, the song you took the title of the book from. It was 1963. You with Hal David and Dionne Warwick, as so many were. Well, let's hear. 1963, Anyone Who Had a Heart.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me. and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so.
Dionne Warwick, of course, singing there. Anyone Who Had a Heart, 1963, written by Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Burt Bacharach is with us. It's the title of his new memoir. Burt, you say right in the beginning of the book, I think that what you write is what you are. So what do we hear in your... I mean, we recognize your music. We recognize it. It's not hard to... But what is that? Who are you? Who's the... What's the Burt Bacharach in that sound?
I think it's... It's a combination, like, of what's come into my life. I mean, not direct events, Tom, not specifics, not like I was in Hawaii and I heard this melody. No, it's being diligent, going to your whether it's your guitar or your piano, and working and keeping your fingers in it and keeping your mind in it. And trying to be, I mean, that song that you just played, Tom, Anyone That Had a Heart, was kind of groundbreaking. I mean, in the sense that if you listen to this first four bars, the time signature changes with every bar. And at the very end, on the turnaround at the end, the time signature is 7/8. That means seven beats to a measure. And musicians in the studio, and there were a lot of musicians in that studio that worked with me all the time making these records, they hadn't seen anything like that. And it was kind of a little bit groundbreaking because, you know, you could always come with that adage, Tom, well, who can dance with, you know, 7/8?
Right.
And it's going from 5/4 to 4/4, 5/4. Yeah. But it, not intentional. It was just the way this melody kind of unfolded. I heard it, then I wrote it down on a piece of paper, and I said, well, that is a 5/4 bar to start out.
Yeah.
And then it goes to a 4/4 bar. But it all has to feel natural, so we can't feel, well, I'm forcing something here. I'm kind of wedging something in to make it more unusual, make it more difficult. The last thing in the world I ever wanted to do was make it more difficult for the listener and also for the people that would play it. And I think you could also take a song like Promises, Promises and make a case for that, the title song of the show, Promises, Promises, and the urgency that I felt that I had to create musically because of the situation in the script. In the way that play unfolds, that Chuck Baxter, the hero, has just been kind of passed over from one boss to another boss, has promised him a job, and he's kind of sick of it, and he makes a statement, promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises. And it was a wicked song to sing, but it was most important that it had the urgency of his attitude, saying, I'm through with these promises. And so Jerry Orbach, who sang it in the original, would see me after 3 months backstage. He said, God, this is tough. I had to write so many notes and so many words. And I said, because, you know, it has to express your total frustration and your total anger, having been duped over and passed over for a job.
So that one began with an idea or lyrics, I guess, promises, promises. How often was that the begin? Did you start with words, an idea, or would you go to the melody first sometimes?
Tom, I think things like a musical, which Promises, Promises was, with a Neil Simon book, who is telling the story, and the story goes up to a certain point where a song comes in, then that lyric has to be a continuation of what Neil Simon book is saying. So it would not work It wouldn't work for me at all, writing music first, and then in that case, Hal David, writing a lyric to it. So everything kind of came with lyric first. Another example would be Alfie. Mm-hmm. Okay, that had to be what that motion picture was really about. Mm-hmm. Alfie is just for the moment we live, you know.
Yeah.
It had to be telling a story that would be the story of the movie without giving the whole picture away.
Burt Bacharach, Stand By in Santa Monica, California. New memoir is Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life in Music by the great Burt Bacharach. There was a time when everybody was singing one of his songs, even the Beatles. Here's Baby, It's You, 1961, lyrics by Mac David and Luther Dixon, composed by Burt Bacharach, my guest today. You can join us. Was his music the soundtrack of your youth? Every time you turned around, every time a radio was on, Burt Bacharach. What's your question on how he did it, on where these songs came from? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Burt Bacharach. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Oh, it doesn't matter what they say. I know I'm gonna love you any old way. What can I do when it's true? Cause baby, it's you. Baby, it's you. Don't leave me all alone. Come on home.
Don't make me over.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the iconic pop hitmaker, composer of the 60s, 70s, and more, Burt Bacharach. He's written 73 top 40 hits, a huge cultural figure. He's out with a new memoir, Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life and Music. Joins us today from Santa Monica, California. Behind us right here, 1962, Don't Make Me Over. It marked the recording debut of Dionne Warwick, sparked a relationship, long relationship, with the three at the heart of this triangle that made so many hits, Burt Bacharach, Hal David, lyricist, and Dionne Warwick. You can join the conversation this hour. Was this the soundtrack of your youth? How would you explain to a young listener now how omnipresent Burt Bacharach's songs were? What's the one, the two, the three that just swamped you? What is it that makes you recognize a Burt Bacharach song? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Burt Bacharach, introduce us to Dionne Warwick and how you were introduced to her, what you thought of her when you first met, how she came so deeply into your life and music.
Well, it was by kind of a beautiful accidental occurrence. I was had written a song called Mexican Divorce with Bob Hilliard that the Drifters were going to record, and Lieber and Stoller were producing. And I was close to Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. And they said, we're going to have the Drifters sing Mexican Divorce, but we want to use a background vocal group. So we'll bring these four girls in. They sing gospel. Can you work with them for about a week? Teach them the background parts on Mexican Divorce to sing behind the Drifters. And these four women came in. They were great. I mean, they'd all been singing in church. They were all related. I couldn't tell who the best singer was because you had Sissy Houston, Whitney's mother.
Yeah.
Sissy Houston. You had Myrna Smith, a cousin. You had Dee Dee Warwick, Dionne Warwick's sister. And you had Dionne Warwick. They made a splendid sound. They made a very unique, special sound. They were very musical. I couldn't tell you which was better, which one was better. I can tell you there was something about Dionne, just the way she carried herself, the way she looked, wearing sneakers, high cheekbones, pigtails. and kind of special looking, very, looked a little bit like a star.
Yeah, I'd say.
And she came in and sang for Hal and myself, Hal David and myself, after we had recorded Mexican Divorce, which was a fun record. It was not a big hit, to say the least, but that was my introduction to Dion. And Dion came in by herself without the other three about 6 weeks later, sang for me and for Hal. And she was kind of amazing. I mean, this was an amazing voice. And the way this unfolded then, Don't Make Me Over, which you just were playing, was the very first record that we ever made with her. And she was a workhorse in the studio. You know, it wasn't like, I'm tired, can we take a break? With an orchestra there. I mean, I think we did 38 takes on Don't Make Me Over, which quite excessive because you're gonna go over the peak. But, you know, it was early in my career, too, of actually making the record where I wrote the orchestration, conducted the band, was basically in control producing the record with Hal David. And so I hadn't refined it yet that you don't need to go maybe to 38 takes because you're going to lose some of the intensity and some of the focus from some of the people involved.
Yeah.
But the thing with Dion, Don't Make Me Over is a very wide-ranging, kind of wide emotional song. The more I could see what Dion could do musically, what she was capable of, and you were playing Anyone I Had a Heart before, it was really like making clothes for an artist, making it so it fit them. It fit them like, and with every succeeding record, she was more capable of doing it. You were mentioning before, and we were talking, Tom, about Promises. And you know how labored that was on stage, night after night, because it was a stage situation with a certain kind of energy coming.
Sure.
With Dion in the studio, it was just floating through it. I mean, on a feather. I mean, totally not labored, totally in control, and you never felt stressed out. And she was just... But she had this kind of unique, special quality that could make her explode vocally, could also make her very intimate, warm, and sound like nobody else that I'd ever heard.
And what a famous and unbelievable collaboration. Burt Bacharach is with us. I want to ask you about another woman. This was a revelation to me in your memoir. I just didn't know about a quite substantial relationship you had with a performer that we think of as from another era, Marlene Dietrich, a big role in your early professional life. I want you to explain it to us, but if we could just hear, this isn't your music, but it's Marlene Dietrich talking about you. This was 1960. She's singing one of the songs she often sang. It was Falling in Love. Her arranger and conductor at that time was you. You were 32 years old with your orchestra. And here she is, Marlene Dietrich, singing Falling in Love from the 1930 film, The Blue Angel. And she opens up with this big gush of a speech about my guest today, Burt Bacharach.
He's my teacher, he's my critic, he's my accompanist, he's my arranger, he's my conductor. And I wish I could say he's my composer. But that isn't true. He's everybody's composer. And his name is Burt Bacharach. And here's the song from The Blue Angel. Falling in love again. Never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Marlene Dietrich, a force from another era, but overlapping in a serious way with our guest today, Bert Bacharach. Bert, that was not a chance meeting. You worked together a lot. You traveled the world together. You were 25 years or so apart in age. And yet this was an intense and significant relationship in your life.
Well, it was a wonderful way to see the world, Tom. Musically, it was miles away from where I was, because I was making records with the Shrills and Chuck Jackson and Dion, and then getting on a plane and flying to Warsaw and conducting for Marlena. And as I say, it was a special way to see the world. South America, even Russia, when Russia was a terrible place to go and be on tour for 3 weeks in Russia. Marlena always very supportive of me, very kind. And she basically let me coach her, and let me make her feel as comfortable as I could make her feel. And she became very secure with me conducting behind her. And musically, it was kind of like very shallow. I mean, but music is music.
You said she had about one octave range, Marlena Dietrich, not exactly Dion.
Yeah, and also we would come into a place and Marlena, say, it would be the Olympia in Paris, and Marlena would have orchestra rehearsals for 8 days. And after 2 days, I don't know what to do with the orchestra because talk about peaking. But she was a perfectionist. I learned a lot about going for that 100% just by watching her on stage. Listen, she was my friend. She was very supportive of when Promises opened. She sent 50 of the New York Times reviews to her people all over the world, her friends, critics, theater owners like Bruno Kokotrix, who ran the Olympia Theater in Paris, and just so proud of me, but had this kind of split for her, because the more famous I became, the less likely it would be that I would continue to be able to work for her. And I do think, you know, she was a very special friend.
You write that you had to be careful not to fall in love with her. You said it would, despite the age, it would have been like falling in love with fire, you write in the book.
Yeah, and also you just, you don't get involved really with somebody that you're working for, because that sets up a pattern. If you're conducting every night behind somebody that you just got out of bed with, that's not good. That's
no,
not good.
No.
That gets you into trouble. I know when we were playing the Olympia in Paris, Quincy Jones, who was a good friend of mine and who I utter respect for, came backstage after the show and said, "Bert, what are you doing, man? This, you should be back in New York
get out of here.
Making R&B records.
Yeah.
And you're doing Go See What the Boys in the Back Room."
And yet you write, you describe walking with Marlena Dietrich at night in the hills of Rio and hearing the rhythms coming up out of that city, the great city of Brazil, those rhythms coming into your music. There's so much here. I mean, it's hard to know where to turn, but I want to get another voice in. That's a great story in itself. Get the book. It's incredible about Marlena Dietrich. But here's to go in a completely different direction. 1965, you again, Bert Bacharach and Hal David with What's New, Pussycat? You mentioned that one. Here it is, Tom Jones.
Pussycat, pussycat, I've got flowers and lots of hours to spend with you. So go and powder your cute little pussycat nose. Pussycat, pussycat, I love you. Yes, I do. You and your pussycat knows. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's new, pussycat? Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Okay, Quincy Jones tells you to get back to New York and do R&B. But here's this. How do you describe, what kind of music is this, Bert?
Well, this is the first movie that I was able to score. Charlie Feldman gave it the job to write the whole score for What's New, Pussycat.
For Woody Allen's film,
Yeah, and it was like a very strange, offbeat picture. And I had never scored a film. And I was with Angie Dickinson at the time, and she was an enormous help as far as changing reels, because we didn't have DVDs then, you know.
Your wife at the time, yeah. Yeah,
sure. Yes. I wasn't my wife yet.
Oh, not yet. Okay.
When we were, right before we got married, and we were living together part-time in London.
Okay.
And I was having the hardest time writing the music for this film. But I kept focusing it, because I always tried to, with any film I ever did, focus in on what was happening on the screen and not think of, oh, this melody, maybe that could step out and become a hit.
Yeah.
You just, I cannot think that way. I have to service the film and make it right for the situation in the picture.
But you challenge the people working on this picture. I mean, you write that the crew, the movie crew, was sort of set back at how kind of, I don't know, weird or unusual this song was. As big
a
hit as it
became. I kept looking at Peter Sellers, at his character, Dr. Fassbender, and how weird and offbeat he was.
Yeah.
And so this theme, this melodically first, came directly from watching him over and over again, and the craziness that he portrayed in the film. And that's exactly where I went, not thinking, well, who could we get to record it, and will it be a hit? I don't think that way. And that's how it came out, very kind of offbeat. If you can say, where is it a connection to any other kind of music? Yeah, you could say, maybe it's a little Kurt Weill-ish.
Yes, very much so. And but then you put Tom Jones in there, and whoa, you're off.
Oh, and Tom did not want to do it. He came over to the condo. Not to the condo, I was in a flat.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Racing to, finish the score, which had so much more music to write. And Tom came over to the flat, and I played him the song, and he had just had this hit, It's Not Unusual, very soulful, and he just wanted to be an R&B, sing out, go for the rafters kind of singer. And he heard the song, and he didn't like it. He didn't understand it. He didn't get it. Didn't want to do it. Did not want to do it. And his manager, I think it might have been Brian Epstein at the time, maybe not. Might be another manager, but
yeah.
Talked him into it. Said, "Listen, this picture's going to be a big hit." So Tommy came into the studio, and I created a situation where we would have those background girls have an orchestra, Tom singing live, right to film, and having not one piano, not two, but five pianos all playing on that track, which he had not heard anything, nor had anybody really maybe done something with five pianos. Tack pianos, so the tacks were in the mallets inside the piano, and that kind of gives it that further kind of Germanic craziness.
Clinky, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Well, he found the gusto somewhere. He really laid it down there. Burt Bacharach, it's so wonderful to have you with us. Please stand by there in Santa Monica. The new memoir is Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life and Music by Burt Bacharach. Pop music, pop culture, great. We've got a lot of callers who've been waiting. I'm going to come to them after the break, I promise. Here, we'll go out of this segment with A House Is Not a Home, Burt Bacharach and Hal David, 1964, performed by Dusty Springfield. Here he worked with so many great artists. You can join us. What is it that makes you recognize a Burt Bacharach song? And how do you hear these songs now? What do you feel about them? Do they take you back somewhere? Do you still love to hear them? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with iconic pop hitmaker, composer, the 60s, 70s, and more, Burt Bacharach. Behind me, the instrumental version of Burt Bacharach's 1966 song, Nikki, a piece named for his daughter, who was born very prematurely that same year to Burt and his wife at the time, Angie Dickinson. Burt Bacharach joins us today from Santa Monica, California. His new memoir, really interesting, is titled Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life and Music. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org, and see our playlist there as well. And you can join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Burt, our listeners have been very patient, waiting to speak with you. Let me begin to bring them in, if I may. San is calling from Burlington, Vermont. San, you're on the air with Burt Bacharach.
Great. Hi, Tom. Hi, Burt.
Hi there.
Hey. It's a good thing you got me up in the queue, because I have to go back and teach music in school, because thanks to you, I became a musician and a music teacher.
Thank you. Glad
yeah, your
helped
music
you along
is
the way.
So awesome.
Thank you.
I want to share with you that I can remember being in fifth grade, going to Ocean City, New Jersey, sitting in the car, listening to Close to You. I totally remember it. Your CD of, like, I got, like, your greatest hits. It's like one CD I will not ever get rid of. Where
Thank
others
you.
Come and go, I hang on to it. So
appreciate.
I would probably have a million questions, and I know there's a lot of other listeners who want to talk, so I just want to say one more thing, and that is this quote of yours that I really remember. You said, in order to play music or compose music, you have to learn the rules. Break the rules.
And, absolutely true.
I didn't start studying till I was 40, and I think you really helped me get there.
Don't you feel better that way than playing by ear or something? I think if you learn the rules, then you can break them. Learn how to be able to, if you're a young writer and you're aspiring to be a composer, and if you're able to hear it in your head, if you're on an airplane, on a train, in a car, you can take even a cocktail napkin and write out a music staff and be able to write what you're hearing on a piece of music paper. That's sort of what I'm talking about, instead of taking a shortcut and saying, I'll just dump it into a tape machine.
Which may be more common these days. San, thank you very much for your call, San. Burt, you had a lot of formal musical training. I mean, it wasn't your high school performance that put you on this path. You write that you were 360th out of 372 at Forest Hills High in New York. So it wasn't exactly about hitting the books that way that made you, but you did a lot of formal study.
See, I didn't know how bad my marks were in school. Bob Greenfield, who did the book with me, Bob really checked out certain things, aspects of my life that I didn't even know about.
Oh, like boy. Thanks a lot,
school,
Bob. Yeah.
Yeah. My high school records at Forest Hills High School. Yeah, I was. Then I understood why, when I went to apply after high school to get into Oberlin, I was turned down. Mm-hmm. Juilliard, turned down. Eastman, turned down. You just had to look and say his high school record was dismal. I mean, a really low and percentile.
But in the end, what did it matter? You studied the music,
yeah.
You learned it. Though even there, your mother had to sort of practically whip you to study the piano.
Absolutely, but it's also like, isn't there a book called There Is Life After High School?
Yes, I guess so.
My mother, just wanted me to have a piano and learn so I could play for my enjoyment. Not for a career, but for my own enjoyment, and she played the piano, and she played by ear, and I envied that. I just said, Mom, just teach me how to play by ear. Well, you can't learn to play by ear. You either play by ear or you don't. But she stayed on me. She pushed. So came home from school. I had to practice for a half an hour before I could go out and play with friends, and I'd have to take a piano lesson once a week in New York City, and hated it all. I mean, for a substantial period of time. It was not my mother kind of pushing, leaning on me. we wouldn't be having this conversation now, Tom, you know.
Yeah.
I'd be in the men's clothing business or something somewhere.
Yeah, a lot of women along the way, men too, but a lot of women here. I mean, to just push it ahead, this was 1982. That's what Friends Are For, such a big one. This was written by you and your wife at that time, Carol Bayer Sager, originally performed by Rod Stewart for the film Night Shift, and then later by Dionne Warwick and Gladys Knight, Elton John, and Stevie Wonder. Marked a return to Dionne Warwick after some time away. That's what Friends Are For. 1985.
And I never thought I'd feel this way. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad I got the chance to say that I do believe I love you. And if I should ever go.
That's what Friends Are For. There's a cool in so much of your music, Bert, and I wondered, were you trying to be cool? Was it just the sound of the time? Did you make the sound of the time?
I don't think you can try to be cool. But by the way, I want to say I do love that song, and I do love that record, and I do love the kind of potency and that power that that song took us to, because it was right on the cusp of everything breaking loose with the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
And it was a very important song, and it was a charity record that we made for AMFAR.
Raised $3 million for AIDS research and treatment.
Yeah. Which was not even a drop in the bucket.
Still, at that time, that was pretty good, pretty important.
And I do love the way everybody sounds on the record. So it's one of those things that you love the finished product. About what you were saying about a sound, the cool. I don't. They kind of labeled me in England before I really took off in the States. I was more popular in England, like easy listening music. Well, I don't think I'm. You got to label me on something. Label me whatever you want to call me. Elevator music, easy listening music. The one thing I can identify maybe with when you were referring to something cool or identifying sound. So many of these songs were born with the orchestration, which, as I wrote the song, I was hearing where this orchestra would be playing, where they would come in, the strings, where the horns would come in, what the drum pattern might be, the bass pattern. So they were born together. They were created together. So maybe there is a correlation between song and the sound of the way I was treating it musically, orchestrally.
Tony in the Bronx.
Yes.
Yeah, maybe. Tony, you're on the air with Bert Bacharach from the Bronx. Hi, Tony, you're on.
Hi,
hey,
Tom.
Tony.
Hi, Bert.
Hey, Tony.
How you doing, buddy?
Good, man.
Belated happy birthday to you. I heard your birthday was this past Sunday.
Thank you for that. Thank you for your good wishes.
Oh, and I have a small story from probably you'll be better at it than me. You played at the MGM Grand in 1980, and my parents brought us there to summer vacation every year, and I was about 16 and a half. My sister's about 21, and she calls out to you right after your first little opening song and interrupts your show to ask for an autograph. And you told her very, very, you know, gently, sweetheart, we got a show going on here, but by all means, you come see me after the show, and I'll give you an autograph, which it was great. And then the show went on. Show ended. My sister says, we got to go see him. I said, we're not going to get back there. She looked at the stage. She goes, let's go on the stage. And we both jumped on the stage from the table and found your dressing room. You opened the door like in shock, saying, oh, all right, you finally got to me. I don't know how you got here. And you were so nice. You gave her an autograph. She was just thrilled.
And, say hello for me.
You know,
it's been a while.
It's good.
I highly doubt you remember it, but it was definitely something that stuck with me, and you know, I have a lot of respect for you as a performer, that's for sure. And a great,
I do appreciate
chum with your fans, that's for sure.
But my question
would be with the internet and YouTube and all these gizmos. I'm 50. I was 50 when I was 11, so I understand it. I get it. But the way to find talent now, do you feel that it's going to get back to a time where we're tripping on people in a bar or in a club and finding them that way, than this whole genre of being on Dancing with the Stars and X, Y, and Z? It just feels so, you know, I'm disconnected from it. Not that I don't appreciate the talent, but it's just, it seems too canned.
It's a totally different world now, Tom. You used to be able to break new artists on radio. Radio is kind of now very deficient. The playlist would vary from city to city. Individual program directors would have control of what they played rather than being working off a playlist that a chain would have, Clear Channel or something would have 150 stations under their control, everybody playing a short playlist. So new music was not being really kind of exposed. And, you know, in the earlier days, what you were talking about, an artist could have a record, say, in New Orleans, and a DJ could fall in love with that record and play it on the air and get a reaction and have it start selling and then spread to Detroit, maybe, and spread into the Midwest. And then you could gradually build a record instead of... but this is very difficult now with the internet. I mean, it's got pluses. I mean, it was kind of wonderful. Remember the artwork and that went into into LPs.
Yeah, the covers, even just the covers.
Those
sure.
were.
Yeah,
how creative those things were. The LPs. Maybe there will be a resurrection, a very small one, of going right back to vinyl, because there is a big difference between vinyl, the way vinyl sounds, and what's sounding digital.
We want to hear a little more of your sound, Alfie, 1965, with the English singer Cilla Black, first collaboration with Burt Bacharach. Written for the film of the same name, produced in the famed Abbey Road Studios with Beatles producer George Martin. Alfie.
What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about when you sort it out, Alfie? Are we meant to take more than we give? Or are we meant to be kind and...
Alfie, Celeste is calling from Hilton Head Island, South Carolina. Hi, Celeste. You're on with Burt Bacharach.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Bert. I can't tell you how excited I am to hear about your book. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you, Celeste.
Definitely an important part of the soundscape of my teenage years. I was a classically trained pianist, but for my senior night in 1971, I played Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head on the piano. But I think one of my favorite, like, R&B songs, you did, Baby, It's You. That was a fabulous song.
Thank you.
But I just can't believe all the collaborations you've had in your lifetime with so many musical giants. And one of them that I really admire that we haven't mentioned yet today is Elvis Costello.
Sure.
Thank you for mentioning that, you know, because that's, I'm very proud of that one.
Right up to date.
That's from the Painted for Memory album, and we're going to make that into a Broadway musical. And Chuck Lorre, who's the Two and a Half Men showrunner, and also
Big Bang Theory,
has had this passion to make this into a musical. He's written the book with Steven Sater, who wrote the book for and lyrics for Spring Awakening. They've written the book. Elvis and I, we've got the original score. We're going to use about 7 songs from the original record and write about 6-7 new songs. And I'm excited about that.
That is pretty cool. From the 1998 Painted from Memory. Look for that on stage with Chuck Lorre involved. Big honors for you and posthumously for Hal David last year, the Library of Congress Gershwin Award. You sang there, and I want to hear just a little bit of that. I mean, there was Sheryl Crow and Michael Feinstein, Diana Krall, Lyle Lovett, Mike Myers, Stevie Wonder. But you also there singing and on piano, What the World Needs Now is Love.
Lord, we don't need another mountain. There are mountains and hillsides enough to climb. There are oceans and rivers enough to last, enough to last till the end of
Burt Bacharach singing his own What the World Needs Now is Love at the Gershwin Awards. How do you look at the gift now, Burt, the gift you had all through your life? Do you still use it? Do you still write? And how do you look back on it, what it's given you?
Oh, yeah, I'm writing and doing touring. We're going on a European tour. We just played Brazil 4 weeks ago.
Yeah.
And played concerts in Brazil and going to do concerts in Europe starting in June. And that's very important to me, Tom, because it gives me a chance to be playing my music before an audience and connecting with them in that way. And I don't play rock and roll up there. What you know of my music is what you're going to basically hear. And it's going to be looking to just touch people emotionally if I can do that. And that's a great gift. And I treasure that. I really do. Being able to stand on a stage and conduct my own music.
Well, no one can accuse you of not having exercised your gift, Burt Bacharach. 73 top 40 hits. I think you put it to pretty big use. New memoir is Anyone Who Had a Heart, My Life and Music, Burt Bacharach in Santa Monica. It's been an honor and a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great talking with you, Tom. Thank you so much.
Burt Bacharach. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. Thank you.